Northwestern Energy continues to work on plans to purchase 11 hydroelectric dams from PPL Montana. The approximately $900 million deal will have to be approved by the State Public Service Commission. Capital reporter Dan Boyce tells us Northwestern updated members of the Montana legislature on their plans.
Northwestern Energy CEO Bob Rowe says the utility currently does not own most of the infrastructure that generates electricity for its customers. He says not only would that change if the deal to purchase PPL Montana's dams goes through, Northwestern would own most of its generating infrastructure, but it would also be mostly renewable.
The resources serving our Montana customers post-transaction would be about 50% hydro or wind.
He's speaking to the legislature's Energy and Telecommunications Interim Committee. It's just to provide information to the lawmakers on the committee. It's not the legislature that has jurisdiction to approve the sale of the dams. It's the Public Service Commission. Northwestern will be filing their application with the PSC in December. In the application, they will be trying to convince the PSC the purchase is in the long-term interest of ratepayers. Northwestern Vice President of Supply John Hines says the dams are in good shape. Prices for Northwestern customers would increase in the short term about 5%.
There will be an initial upfront, relatively small increase. From then on, we expect that increase to be flat.
He says in about 10 years, the utility should be able to offer lower prices with the dams than without them.
From then on through the next 60, 70, 80 years, potentially, it'll be a lower cost alternative.
The purchase would reunite the state's primary electricity provider with this collection of hydroelectric dams. It was all owned by the Montana Power Company, which broke apart following deregulation legislation passed in 1997. For 10 years, Northwestern was not allowed to own its own electric generation. That was allowed again in 2007, and Northwestern began purchasing generation infrastructure. Roundup Republican Senator Alan Olson says this purchase would provide predictability in utility costs.
The opportunity to take that risk out of the markets, I think, will go a long ways towards the stability that we used to have with the old Montana Power Company.
The Public Service Commission will have 9 months to evaluate Northwestern's purchase application after it's submitted in December. That means a final decision will likely be made in September 2014. I'm Dan Boyce reporting at the Capitol.
And in other news from around the state, the independent reviewer tracking the Missoula Police Department's compliance with an agreement with the U.S. Justice Department says much progress has been made, but substantial work has yet to be accomplished. That agreement was reached following an investigation into how local police investigate reports of sexual assault. Law enforcement consultant Tom Tremblay prepared the report, which covers the period between June 19th and October 1st of this year. It included sexual assault case reviews, policy development, sexual assault response, and investigations training. All Missoula Police Department officers and command staff have completed sexual assault response and investigations training. The review also says the department is seeking comments, feedback, and agreement on policy language from various community agencies that provide services to sexual assault victims and survivors. Chief Mark Muir says the department had already been working to develop a more victim-centered approach to handling sex crimes before reaching the agreement with the DOJ. Muir says it's too early to definitively say the effort is producing positive results. That said, more reports have been filed with the department starting in May of last year. On the first 9 months of 2011, there were 23 reports of sexual intercourse without consent. In the first 9 months of 2012, there were 62. 54 cases were reported in the first 9 months of this year.
That increased reporting has possibly been tied in with the fact that we began encouraging reporting and had a very high public awareness campaign, both in the Missoula community in general and specifically a heavy emphasis on the University of Montana campus, where we did a significant amount of work to reach out to the community with the idea that bystander intervention and reporting were two of the things that the community could help us with the most.
A review of 18 closed sexual assault cases showed 12 with no indication of any problems. Six of the 18 cases showed some relatively minor issues that could be resolved through future training of a detective or officer.
Using words of non-consensual sex versus using words that make it sound like the sex was consensual. consensual in some way. In the case of a sexual intercourse without consent, I mean, the implication there is that it is an act at the hands of one party against another party. And so using words like, and then they had sex, is language that revolves around consensual sex, whereas using a word where indicating the perpetrator had intercourse with the victim.
The report indicates a lack of coordination between Missoula police and the county attorney's office to ensure timely case reviews and charging decisions from the county attorney's office. County attorney Fred Van Valkenburg has been a vocal critic of DOJ's attempts to investigate his office's handling of sexual assault cases. He maintains it has no authority to do so and adds neither he nor his staff have done anything wrong to warrant an investigation. Van Valkenburg says he does not agree with the report's conclusion there's reason for concern about timely case reviews.
And I don't think the police department thinks that either. So, you know, I think that that's sort of one of the things you have to deal with when you have people from somewhere outside Montana trying to impose their attitudes and beliefs on us.
The report suggests a case review and charging decision protocol should be developed between Van Valkenburg's office, the police, and the University of Montana's Office of Public Safety.
I don't know what that means. It sounds like something that's far more formal than necessary. All we need is to simply talk to each other.
Police Chief Muir says Van Valkenburg has been very cooperative with his department.
He is happy to consider changes to his own office's protocol that will assist us in doing better work and to assist victims. And so we continue to meet and are working on issues with respect to that so that when I leave next month, hopefully we will have in place a solid protocol for the way that his office will make a priority of these cases like we have done here at the police department.
Van Valkenburg says the Department of Justice has not made any move to force him to cooperate with its desire to investigate his office's handling of sexual assault cases.
Where bats hibernate, how warm or cold, and how dry or damp the environment is are questions being asked as researchers and recreationists explore Montana's caves. Part of the push to gather this information comes from a threat posed by a disease that's been wiping out bats on the East Coast. Catchin Fry reports white nose syndrome hasn't spread as far west as Montana yet, and researchers and land managers are looking to find out as much about the area's nocturnal bug eaters as they can.
Bat specialist Dr. Corey Lawson with Wildlife Conservation Society Canada says some species of bats are facing potential extinction because of the white nose syndrome, which has been decimating bat populations along the East Coast and is spreading west.
It really is a race to save our bats, because we don't know how much time we have to find out all this critical information, but we do know at this point it's limited.
Lawson says white nose syndrome has made it to Ontario and Canada. They also have concerns about white nose syndrome reports in Minnesota, right on the U.S.-Canada border. Lawson has studied bats in the North Fork Flathead River drainage in Montana, and just this past summer began surveying the caves of the Flathead River Valley on the north side of the border. She says this area is good for bat hunting because of the numerous cave formations in the area. The area may prove a bellwether for what's happening with bats in the province. Zoologist Bryce Maxwell with the Montana Natural Heritage Program says white nose syndrome invades bats while they're roosting.
Wakes them up because of the skin irritation. It'll even eat, you know, holes through their wings. So it wakes them up during those periods. And when they wake up, they burn through critical fat supplies. And so they basically starve to death in the middle of the winter.
Maxwell says Montana is conducting a two-pronged research effort. First, they're monitoring bat roost sites in the summer and the places they hibernate, or hibernacula, in the winter. They're also using acoustic detectors to track and find different species of bats. He says what's coming out of this research is a more complex picture of what bats do. Managers have partnered with cavers to collect some of the data from these often hard-to-reach caves. One such club is the Big Fork High School Cave Club, sponsored by science and GIS mapping teacher Hans Bodenhammer. He says the club has discovered up to 6 previously undiscovered bat hibernacula.
Which is really cool. I mean, if white nose syndrome does make it this far, we've got an idea of what areas we need to really be careful with.
Sophomore Alexa Cornett says they collected data on bats and other information about caves from a trip this past weekend to Lewistown and White Sulphur Springs.
One of our biggest caves was where we had to take most of the data, and we were searching for bats is one of the things we mostly search for. And we were taking dirt samples for white nose syndrome. And another thing we look for in the caves is graffiti.
Junior Sarah Abbott says they're using the information in class to build a map of the caves.
Mr. Bonehammer normally draws up a map on a computer, and then some of us students, we go in and we fill out that data and put it in there, normally as points or as polys, which a poly is a collection of dots. And so we normally do the biology, the mineral, any bat signs, and also temperature of the cave, too.
Research is continuing into the winter to find the different characteristics of the bat's hibernacula, compare the caves here to the caves in the east hit with white nose syndrome, and find out how vulnerable Montana's bats are and what, if anything, can be done. Katrin Fryett reporting from the Flathead.
2013 has been a deadly year for wildland firefighters, including the loss of 19 members of a hotshot crew on a fire near Yarnell, Arizona. Their shocking deaths raise new questions about firefighting policy and about the proper response to our changing climate and growing wildland-urban interface. These are issues renowned environmental historian Char Miller has been pondering and writing about for some time. Miller was in Missoula this week to lecture at University of Montana. The director of the Environmental Analysis Program at Pomona College is an expert on U.S. environmental history and politics and public land management. In this feature interview, Miller talks with news director Sally Mock about the Yarnell tragedy and the questions it provoked.
It, as with all of the other fires over the set of recent years, but also over the last 50 or so, have raised questions about how we think about fire in its relationship to landscapes, in relationship to the housing that we are now living within, which are often within these fire zones, and what the kind of public response ought to be. And so part of the thing about the Yarnell Hill fire for me was not simply that they died, horrific though that was, it's where they were when they died. And they're standing between a fire and a new subdivision. And that strikes me as not only a dangerous place to be on the one hand, but also raises public questions. Questions in terms of policy of why are these subdivisions being located in places that we know burn and must burn. In often cases, they require fire to really regenerate themselves. So we've not done a really good job in our communities and our regions and our states or even nationally thinking about what kind of controls we might want to place on our own behavior, because in the end, that's the issue. Firefighters, we're asking them to go out to protect us, but we're not asking what we're willing to do to protect them. And I think that's the central issue we need to address.
Is it realistic to imagine that there would be a county or a city or a zoning commission say to anybody, you can't build here because the danger of fire is too high?
It's not realistic, but that doesn't stop me from proposing it. I think part of the other issue is actually there are ways to incentivize and de-incentivize where one lives. And so insurance companies certainly have a role to play in here, whether they will insure you. They don't insure you in flood zones, so why are they insuring you in fire zones? Or if you want to build in a flood zone, look at the premium or simply say, I don't want insurance, which is also a crazy thing to do. So there's that sort of market approach. The state of California has enacted a tax for those who live within the fire zones that they can identify. It's a small tax, but the money go directly to Cal Fire to help it support this larger process of not simply suppressing fire, but also educating people about defensible space around their homes. And that, in the end, may be the sort of initiative that towns can do, which is to say, look, if you're choosing to live here and we can't stop you from so doing, you need to know that these are the kinds of things that you ought to do, must do to protect not just your house, but to protect those public servants who we will send racing out to your house if fire looms.
I think the other question that the Yarnell tragedy raised was how could this happen given we have a history of firefighters dying to save homes or whatever, and the Forest Service and other firefighting agencies have said to their firefighters, do not put yourself in that kind of harm's way.
Right. Right. And that's, I'm not sure if we'll ever get that answer in this particular case, because all of the men who were engaged in that final decision about whether to move or stay or in any sense protect themselves, we don't know what they decided to do. I mean, we know what the outcome is, but we don't know sort of the calculation that they made. The stories are mounting that they had been online for a long time, and this was one of many fires that they had fought. And so,
and it was their hometown.
And it's their hometown, and you know that becomes all the more important to them. But it's tough. It's a tough set of decisions.
You've written, quote, "The problem does not appear to be one of policy but of memory."
Yes. And I think the part of the issue that I'm trying to raise there is we don't – in 5 years, no one's going to remember Yarnell Hill. No one remembered the Mann Gulch fire. All of these things –
Storm King.
Storm King and the issues that sort of – you know, it's been a long time since we've had one, so I understand why memory fades a bit. But boy, do we really need to remember these things, because that then shapes the actions that we are willing to take.
You mentioned earlier about the responsibility of homeowners, and there have been some studies about why people do or don't do the defensible space thing, because there's been so much education about that. And you wrote, quote, about firefighters, quote, "They die where we live."
Yes, they do. And I think that poses a moral obligation for us as citizens of a broader community to remember that the choices that we make have ramifications for people who will come to save us. And I think that's the central issue, at least from my perspective, that if you're going to put yourself in a fire zone, remember that there are people who will defend you, but you need to defend them. And that requires understanding why defensible space is so crucial and, you know, being willing to make that investment.
I want to switch gears a little bit now and talk about public land management, which
yes.
is something else that you've written a lot about. I spoke with someone recently, a climate scientist, who said that public land management right now has to be more flexible than it's ever been because of climate change, making everything so unpredictable.
Yes. And if fire is unpredictable, so are species migration, so are plants of various kinds moving. I think not only do we need to be more flexible in terms of the actions that we take or propose to take, we actually have to be reevaluating the language that we use to describe the landscapes that we see in front of us. So, for example, the language of preservation framed by John Muir and his successors into an argument about preserving particular places on the ground becomes a lot more difficult when, in fact, those species are moving across that ground and seeking new territory. So is preservation the language necessarily that we want to use any longer to describe how our best landscapes are contained, in a sense? We're going to have to be flexible on questions of just the word invasive. What does that actually mean? Is that a climate refugee that is coming to our landscape in some form, whether it's a plant or animal? Can we actually stop that from happening? Which is another set of issues that I think is going to confound ecologists, policymakers, and park and forest managers, because they're going to be confronting a shifting landscape that hasn't really shifted in quite this way, certainly in human memory, before.
What's your best advice?
My best advice is that we have to do a couple of things, which is that we have to start to recalibrate the way in which we think about public lands management or any lands management, because the other piece of this story is if flora and fauna are moving in a variety of ways, that means they're not going to, and they never have, respect property boundaries. So federal and state and local and private lands are all in this larger landscape scale management conundrum that we have to address. So I think that's one of the things, is to start having a conversation that doesn't acknowledge or doesn't privilege property line. Because in Missoula and everywhere else, we're going to have to deal with these issues. If you look at the fires in the Southwest this summer and over the last 10 years or so, what they have done is, in fact, convert forests to grasslands and shrublands. And if you go farther south and cross over into northern Mexico, you're looking at what's going to happen to Arizona, New Mexico, parts of Texas, and parts of Southern California. And that's not stuff we're prepared to deal with. We're not ready to think about that, which is what I think we have to do.
And the conversation is way overdue, isn't it?
Way overdue. Absolutely way overdue. And in part, it's overdue because of the resistance to the very concept of climate change and the notion that the planet is warming that has become such a political battleground. But the science is really clear. There is no doubt in anyone's mind that sees this material, this data, that this stuff is happening. If birds can figure it out, if aspens can figure it out, why can't human beings?
We'll have it. Speaking with Char Miller, who's environmental historian and director of the Environmental Analysis Program at Pomona College. Dr. Miller, pleasure to have you in our studio.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure for me to be here.
Now for tonight, this weekend's forecast. West of the Divide tonight should be mostly cloudy with lows in the 20s to lower 30s. Tomorrow, look for mostly cloudy skies with highs in the mid-30s to lower 40s. On Sunday, snow is likely, but expect rain in lower valleys. Highs should be in the mid-30s to lower 40s. Central Montana tonight should be mostly cloudy with isolated rain and snow showers. Expect lows 20 to 30 degrees. Tomorrow, look for increasing cloud cover with highs in the 40s. On Sunday, it calls for snow with highs in the 30s. Southwest Montana tonight should be mostly cloudy with isolated snow and lows 20 to 30 degrees. Tomorrow, expect mostly cloudy skies with highs 40 to 45 degrees. And on Sunday, it should be mostly cloudy with a chance of snow and highs in the 40s. And now for the editorial comments of Terry Kendrick.
I met Judy Smith when I was 23 years old, and my life forever changed directions. I worked with her in a variety of projects for the better part of three decades. Judy died Wednesday evening. We will all miss her vision, drive, passion, and brilliance. She was one of the smartest people you could ever hope to meet. She had her doctorate in microbiology, but devoted her life to social justice. Judy was a commanding presence. It helped that she was 6 feet tall, but it was more than that. She was a force of nature. She embodied power and confidence. Not the kind people have when they're trying to climb up the ladder of success, but the kind of confidence that comes from having faith in yourself. She trusted her ability and the ability of others to change the world. Her experience in the 1960s in anti-war protests, working on an underground newspaper, and being involved in the early years of feminism shaped her personality for the rest of her life. She never really went legit. She was always looking for ways to change the status quo. Judy was clear that for her, feminism didn't mean women being equal with men. She didn't like the gender stereotypes that defined men either. She didn't want women to have power over other people, and she didn't want women to fight for an equal piece of a dysfunctional pie. She wanted a different pie, one that was big enough for everyone to have power. Empowerment wasn't a buzzword for Judy. It was her life's work. When I met her in 1981, she was traveling around the state distributing the Montana Divorce Handbook. Judy wanted women to know that they had rights and they didn't have to be victimized by the court system just because they wanted out of a marriage. In the mid-80s, she convened a conference on incest. This was when no one was acknowledging that incest took place. Judy had an amazing ability to anticipate the next wave of change. In the late 80s and early 90s, she was instrumental in making Montana's welfare regulations as progressive as they could be. Women on welfare could attend college or start their own business, along with looking for work. Judy founded Montana Women Vote, a coalition of women's organizations dedicated to increasing low-income women's participation in all levels of our democracy. Judy saw that public policy wasn't going to change if elected officials didn't see low-income women as part of their constituency. And the way low-income women could wield power was at the ballot box. I can't do justice to all her accomplishments. She worked on environmental issues, was instrumental in forming the Smart Growth Coalition, was a founder of the Missoula New Party, a progressive third party that made quite a name for itself in the mid-90s. That was a blast. Talk about shaking up the status quo. Judy could look beyond what was and see what was possible in people. Sometimes she wasn't discerning enough about who she trusted to carry out the work, but maybe that lack of discernment made it possible for people to shine who wouldn't have otherwise had the opportunity. She certainly did that for me over the years. She had infinite patience with my neuroses, my anxieties, and my insecurities. She didn't worry about whether or not you had the skills or knowledge. If you wanted to work on a project, she assumed that you could do the task. She was willing to start things and learn on the way. She didn't wait to make sure she had the credentials or ask for permission before she took on an issue. Judy wasn't perfect, and she wasn't easy. She didn't have the same insecurities that many women had in the early days of feminism. She didn't need to overcome social conditioning and find her voice. She always had hers. When people would criticize her leadership, she would say that she was not going to apologize for being competent. Perhaps the biggest gift Judy gave to people was her time. She took an active interest in helping the next social activist. She was never too busy. She never held herself above the fray. She was always building community. She wanted everyone to have the opportunity to make a difference. Judy wasn't all work and no play. She loved being out in nature. She loved to sing. She loved cats. And she liked to enter things in the county fair. She won ribbons for her flowers and a blue ribbon for a watercolor painting of a fish that is prominently displayed in her house. She loved Montana. It's not possible to talk about Judy without also talking about her sister Lynn, the Smith sisters. Judy spent her whole life with Lynn. They worked together on many projects, shared lots of interests, and Judy was very lucky to have Lynn for her big sister. Countless people in Montana and around the country have been influenced by Judy. So much of my life has been shaped by just knowing Judy Smith. Perhaps Judy's energy has been released by the limitations of this world, and she is out there working to make the universe a better place. This is Terry Kendrick. Thanks for listening.
Terry Kendrick is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Madeline Beck.
And I'm Connor Ballantyne. Thanks for listening and have a great weekend.